Welcome to the Data Morgana podcast, the show in which we explore the future of the internet. I'm your host, Julia Jensen. I'm an artist researching the impact of technology on our society, and I'm a data protection ambassador. Data Morgana is an initiative by Public Spaces, a network of civic society organizations reclaiming the internet as a force for the common good. It's 2025. The internet has fallen into the hands of a few big tech companies. Under the promise to make our world better, more fair and efficient, they collect our data on a massive scale. But does this really make our world a better place? Or is it nothing more than an illusion, a data morgana? In this show, we're looking into hopeful initiatives happening around Europe that are shaping a better digital future. I had a conversation with Maria Farrell, live at the Public Spaces Conference. She is a public speaker and writer on technology, politics, and on life, creating fiction and nonfiction to not just critique technology, but to imagine a technological future where we actively choose to live in. We spoke about many things, her paper that went viral, Rewilding the Internet, about her upcoming book, Rewild and Resist, and something that I find to be extraordinarily fitting for the final episode of this series, hope. Without hope, we can't reshape the internet. Despair is unethical. Well, welcome, Maria. Welcome to the Data Morgana podcast.
Thank you, Julia. It's a delight to be here.
Yeah, I'm also very excited for this talk, and I'm honored that you're here on our show. Since the internet hasn't been in great shape lately, we're exploring the future of the internet and how things must and can be different. And I'm announcing every episode with exploring hopeful initiatives to make the internet a better place. And I think that brings me already to my first question to you, because hope is something that you can elaborate on a lot. Why is hope so important? You even said that we have a duty to hope. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I stole the phrase of the duty to hope or the duty of hope from some diplomats, actually, who were working in the Northern Ireland peace process in the 1990s. And not to give you a big history lesson, but this was a really deep, corrosive conflict which went on for many, many decades and to some extent still goes on. But in the run-up to what became the Good Friday Agreement, it just seemed completely impossible. The sides were so far apart. There was so much, I'm going to say it, like bad faith negotiation and bad faith activities on the part of several of the interlocutors to do with, you know, arms and weapons and all of it. And honestly, if you were a rational person, a sensible, common sense person who is taking part in this, you would just go, guys, this is not going to happen. It's just not rational. There's no reason why this will succeed. And one of my sisters is actually an Irish diplomat, and she worked for the senior Irish diplomat who was in charge of our delegation at that time. And she told me the story that one night before, that, you know, they were all up in like 2 and 3 in the morning on these negotiations. And one night when it was just at the worst, the absolute nadir of it all, and the team just could not get, you know, there's only a certain amount of coffee that's going to give you motivation at that point. And he just turned around to the team, to their team, privately, and just said, look, we have to act as if this is going to work out. We have a duty to act in a hopeful manner. We have to continue to put one foot in front of the other as if at some point in the future this will be okay. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, you know, we keep open the possibility that it will. Well, that was the night when there was a breakthrough. And the fact that they just kept going was so important. And my sister, Nellie, said to me that at the time they almost made a joke of, like, we should put the duty of hope, we should put it on a mug so that we all, every time we have to get our coffee at these endless negotiations, we remind ourselves that, you know, against all odds, against kind of the emotional, pushing like an emotional countercurrent, really, we have a duty to act in hope. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, that story just kind of fell into my heart and my belly, and it just stuck with me, you know, and I started writing about it almost 10 years now ago. Yeah. When Trump was first elected, and, you know, we faced the beginning of the long spiral that we're now in an accelerated way. And the duty of hope became like a really, I guess, a marching call to me, But it also made me think a lot more about what hope is.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So what is hope?
So, okay, I'll tell you what hope is not.
Mm-hmm.
Hope is not optimism, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So often when I'm giving a tech talk or a keynote or whatever it is, I'll do my thing. And very often, because of the kind of material I present and the way I do it, somebody will say, oh, I'm so glad you ended on an optimistic note. You know, or very often, and climate activists get this all the time, they get asked, so are you positive, you know, mm-hmm. are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? And they want you to end in what I think the writer Rebecca Solnit has called the obligatory note of hope.
Mm-hmm. Binary. It's either zero or one.
Exactly. And I feel like it's such a false binary. One, because optimism is just like feeling good about things. It's a feeling. It's not an action.
Mm-hmm.
Hope is like a muscle that you have to, that you have to work and develop and keep. Hope is it's tied up with action. It's also tied up with solidarity, because the only good things that we achieve, especially in progressive politics, are with other people,
right.
are with, you know, collective actions, are with unlikely coalitions. And so I think, I'm always like, at least in my mind and my heart anyway, I try not to be rude, but I really want to push back against this false binary of hope versus of optimism versus pessimism,
mm-hmm.
but also in this kind of almost like emotional obligation of somebody who is like in the trenches, who is doing the work, and who is trying to build coalition and build movement and make change, and how it in these kind of questions, when they're given them, they almost make it like our obligation to make other people feel better about what it is that we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it almost gives you an excuse to go, oh, well, that's great. She's got it handled. She's feeling optimistic about it. So we're all fine.
Yeah, but
like, that's not our job.
That is also individualizing the problem, right?
Right.
And pointing
yeah.
fingers.
Yeah.
What you can and can't do. Yeah,
exactly.
I think it's very interesting that you mentioned that hope is a muscle, because especially, for example, talking about AI a lot, I often try to explain that also our brain is a muscle that we have to keep on practicing. And we can also unlearn certain things, especially kind of simple cognitive things that,
yeah.
you know, we now try to quantify with certain systems. Do you think there's a parallel there in like unlearning, for example, the basic cognitive things that are very, well, human, that we also need to practice a lot, in also maybe, well, unlearning hope?
Yeah. Oh, that's a beautiful way to think about it. I think absolutely. For me, hope and work are built up, are together. And by work, I mean like our life's work, like the work of figuring out who am I? Why am I here? What is the thing that I can do to help our collective life together? And so I think a lot of AI technologies, especially the large language models in particular, but also the, the Midjourney, the image creation stuff, it's really about like de-skilling people from what I do, like as a writer. I'm 52 years old and I've been a writer, a professional writer, for quite a long time. And I'm here to tell you the sad news and the great news that the blank page is terrifying, and it doesn't get easier. And facing into the blank page with your pen or the screen or whatever it is, your notes app on your phone, the work of figuring out, what do I think about this? And how can I articulate what I think about this in a way that is going to bridge the gap between me and another human? Like, how do I craft the message? That doesn't get easier, but it never gets less important either. And so I think hope is about kind of keeping that muscle of that work going. Don't allow somebody to take that away from you.
Right.
You know?
Because there's beauty in friction, and we need to embrace it, because without friction, what is there?
Yeah, friction and waiting and impatience,
right?
Rubbing along, you know, dealing with awkward people, like all of these things. There's, I think you're right, like friction in technology. We have so many specific tech models that, you know, and apps that say we're going to take friction out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're never going to be bored at a bus stop again, because you'll be, you know, you'll be able to doom scroll on your phone. Like, I don't think that's adding anything to my life, but, you know, having the moments. And we talked just before we started about my years without a smartphone. And in those years, I kind of cultivated a habit, which I still have, of, you know, one, always carry a book. Like I was young in the 90s, so we always had to carry a book because there was a lot of waiting around in those times. But also like just having those kind of empty moments that your heart rises to fill and mm-hmm. your mind, you know, suddenly you find things in your mind that you did not know were there.
Yeah,
like, that's how you know who you are.
Yeah, and you also become more receptive of, you know, your environment, yeah. things that are happening, for example, maybe, you know, out of nothing. I think with AI and with this quantification of a lot of systems and processes and, you know, optimizing just for the sake of optimizing it,
yeah.
We're pushing against doubt and risk and the uncertainty of life, where I think that's actually kind of the beauty of people as well.
Oh, this is brilliant. Thank you. I love the way you think about things and talk about them. Yes, doubt and uncertainty they're fundamental to the human condition. So mm-hmm. sorry, guys, we don't get to skip them. Skip those bits and go on to the good bit, you know. But also they're in those tricky moments, you know, doubt about like what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But you know how we can find out what's going to happen next?
Ask ChatGPT.
Yeah, ask ChatGPT or do something.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Seize your future. Decide what you're going to work
live
on.
Live your future. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how you find out what's going to happen next, yeah. by making it happen.
Yeah, I think that's a very hopeful perspective. And I think, you know, I understand that people want to lean into the effort and the comfortness there. But yeah. I think there's a beauty in, and I think it also has to do a lot with our notion of what we have or haven't to hide, you know, in working with these systems, where it's often kind of tailored down in talking about privacy issues, for example, but privacy isn't really what's at stake, right? There's like autonomy, democracy, you already mentioned with Trump reelected. So what do you think, like in our talkings and discussions about it, can we do differently to maybe move forward towards kind of, you know, talking differently about the future of the internet, not talking about having privacy or not?
Yeah. I mean, privacy is kind of one of those it's kind of a receptacle. It's a vessel that a lot of stuff got put into. I think privacy is fundamentally important because it's the thing that allows you to be a person who's not always exposed, who's not always kind of broadcasting. And privacy is one of those key relationships between the citizen and the state, really. That's where privacy came from. But you're right, privacy is not the only bucket that we need to put stuff into. Autonomy, democracy, all of those. Meredith Whitaker, who runs the Signal app, she gave a talk to the Chaos Computer Group just before, between Christmas and New Year's, just this year gone. And she talked about shame and knowledge and how a lot of people who work in and around tech actually are feel really insecure because they don't know a lot of stuff. Like, there's a lot to know about tech. You know, you move from one room into another and suddenly you're the person who knows nothing. And she has an incredibly interesting sort of thing to say about love and shame and how we use technology and how kind of those of us who work in technology, I suppose in some ways need to just get a bit more comfortable with not knowing the answers and being a little bit more vulnerable and maybe sounding a bit silly when we ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a big, you know, and it can be very gendered as well, this idea, this kind of slightly toxic masculinity around knowing everything and getting to decide the future. And, you know, all of the people who run the big companies are, you know, white guys who live in America, have American citizenship.
And they are also more privileged in a way to say that they don't have anything to hide because they will probably not be the victims of most systems because they're the reverence guy.
Yeah. But then again, you look at a guy like Peter Thiel, and one of the first things he did that brought him to a lot of public notice was he used his money and a secret legal litigation plan to kill an online magazine called Gawker, which was a gossip mag. He did that about 10 years ago. He took it down because it published rumors that he was gay. He is gay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing to be ashamed of. But he was so worried about his privacy. His privacy is so important,
right,
that he would literally kill journalism to protect it. And yet he is the person who is running the most privacy invasive, democracy destructive data company pretty much on this planet, Palantir.
Palantir, yeah.
So it's privacy for them, but not for us.
That's insane. And it's also kind of scary because these are the people who are pulling the strings still. And they could easily kind of pinpoint on what should be protected. And it's not, I think it's similar to the whole safety issue, you know, the Ring doorbell and all the surveillance cameras. Safer for whom? You know, it's not safer for everybody. And I think that also kind of taps into this other thing that I read about that you were talking about a lot, was that big tech's narrative is that they are building ecosystems. But you like to use another word for that, right?
Yeah, big tech talks about ecosystems because they have a couple of programs that talk to each other. But what they are running is not ecosystems, it's plantations, basically like intensive agriculture, monoculture, where you just have one crop and you really, go hard on maximizing outputs and controlling inputs, all of that. So, yeah, I wrote an article a few years ago now, basically about how big tech talk of ecosystem, where they try to borrow the some of the associations of competition and flourishing, mm-hmm. And greenness. And they kind of try to bring that whole vocabulary, both visual and emotional.
It sounds magical, right?
Doesn't
this
it?
Ecosystem.
Like little lambs gamboling in the fields and, you know, the spring wind and the sound of bird song.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story to sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when actually what they're building are more like cattle feedlots.
Yeah, very exploitative.
Extremely extractive, fundamentally a colonial type of architecture.
I was just about to ask that because plantations also does sound very colonial. Is that also the reference that you want to make?
Yeah, it is. I think you see, like, plantation is one of those words that has a lot of emotional and political impact. And a year or two ago, actually just last year, a guy who's a lobbyist for kind of a small tech firm actually pulled me up. He's American, and he said, you can't talk of us. You can't describe us as plantations. Like, that brings up slavery and American slavery, and that's not somewhere you're allowed to go, mm-hmm. Because the associations are too dark, and that's just, in our context, that's unacceptable, basically. And I remember saying to him, oh, really? So have you heard of the Ulster plantations? Have you ever heard of those? The Ulster plantations are the colonial expansion of English landowners into Ireland in the 16th and 17th century. Have you heard of plantations in Indonesia, rubber plantations? Mm-hmm. That has a different set of associations in terms of that is extractive agriculture, yes, and it has its own kind of political mood. Basically, the word plantation brings with it a lot of different associations, but one country does not get to own them.
Right.
You know, their plantations are something that have been in and still are a form of agriculture, also a form of history, also a form of extraction, also often a form of slave labor. So there are a lot of different associations with them. And I do very strongly claim the right to bring all of them to the table when I say that the tech industry, big tech, is structured in the form of plantations.
Right. I think it's interesting because in 2016, I graduated from art school, and I actually graduated with this installation where I was claiming that we're suffering from data slavery, or that we've been enslaved by the data business. It was highly controversial in 2016, especially, and I was like a 22-year-old.
That must have been tough. Did you get a lot of pushback?
I did, yeah, from public, but also from teachers and actually from everybody. But it was the start of my kind of fascination for the topic, because I think it's also super interesting. And later on, I read some books that there are a lot of parallels in all the colonizations, the slavery, the whole the systems. And I think it's very interesting because, of course, it's a very delicate term that we have to be very careful to use. I think why people are also kind of scared of it is that it really kind of picks onto the point where people feel very powerless, you know?
Yeah.
Because then what?
Yeah, what then? Right.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, the reason I use ecological terminology is not just to create a set of metaphors. I mean, and metaphors are really important to allow us to re-see something that has become almost invisible because it's so ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But also, I think I use ecology when I am writing and working and talking about how we transform technology, specifically the internet in all its stack, up and down the stack. Basically, because it is a set of ideas, a set of practices, a way of seeing that these things are systems, and they're not just systems, but they're habitats.
Mm.
And so, for one thing, when we think ecologically about the internet and say, "Look, it's an ecosystem that has just gone horribly wrong. It's been really mistreated, frankly. It's been colonized by a tiny group of bad actors."
Mm.
And the consequences are really, are horrific and very apparent.
Yeah.
But it's just not enough to diagnose the problem.
Right.
You have to kind of go, well, okay, so what do we do about it? And well, look, over here, technologists, there's a group of people who are called ecologists, and they have been working for some decades now, many decades, on how to regenerate habitats and ecosystems that have been near destroyed. So there's a whole set of you know, scientific understanding mm-hmm. of knowing that, and even just the all the way from the knowledge that when you give natural ecosystems just a little chance to regenerate, they do it surprisingly quickly mm-hmm. Under most circumstances. But also, I kind of look also to both the emotional and collective resilience of ecologists who have turned their discipline, their field of study, from something that, you know, to some extent was, let's think about taxonomy, let's think about, you know, how different flowers, you know, are related to each other and what categories they go into, and let's look at charismatic species and how we conserve specific species. They've kind of turned it all around and gone, we are now a crisis discipline. Mm-hmm. And my co-author, Robin Bergeon, and I wrote, he actually brought the idea of crisis discipline to me. He said, ecologists have basically said, look, it's not enough to study what we're doing anymore. We have to, as a discipline, work on how do we fix things? How do we regenerate? How do we make space for new things? How do we survive? So I just think that, you know, when we kind of apply ecology to tech, it's a little counterintuitive because in our minds they're opposed to each other. But actually, just starting off from the fact that we're told we live in ecosystems, which are in fact plantations, mm-hmm. and we're also told that only the tech billionaires can hold the future, can know what the future, you know, has in it and can decide what it has in it. Well, actually, no, there's a whole just, you know, a century of humans who have already, several centuries, actually, if you go back to the enclosure movement of the 17th century and onwards, there are centuries of humans who collectively know how to resist this kind of corporate takeover mm-hmm. and this kind of, you know, effectively fascist takeover of the organs, what used to be the organs of state, the people who own data, who own the relationship between you and power. So it's just one way of saying, like, we know how to do this. We don't have to completely reinvent the wheel. And there are people over there that we can learn from if we have just a little bit of humility and a bit of curiosity and also just a bit of like delight and joy. Like, I cannot tell you how much fun it is as someone who's worked in tech for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Like now, because I've learned so much about ecology, like the world looks and feels and smells different to me now. You know, like I was walking down a street in London. I've become such an embarrassing person 2 days ago. And I just looked down at the footpath and the pavement. And there was a little ladybird in the crack. And she was about, or he was about to get squashed. And because when you become a person who becomes obsessed with ecology, you kind of become a person who's just like, nope, stop. Everyone stop. I'm picking up the ladybird.
Yeah. And you can only see that if you're not looking at your smartphone.
Right. Oh, my God. You're so right. Exactly. You're looking around, you know, and then kind of walk with her down the street and find a flower bed for her to go into, which has, because I've become obsessive, flowers that are actually, a lot of street planting is not very kind of pro-pollinators. So finding a nice pro-pollination flower bed for her to go into. Amazing. But, you know, it's just a kind of a silly way of saying, like, we live in a very tricky moment, but there are so many other forms of human wisdom and human practice that we can kind of borrow and be humble and learn about and join in with. And it just brings a whole new set of things to just, I suppose, to be like, have day-to-day joy, you know, to feel like, oh, yeah, there are other people who are doing this. Like we can just row in with them.
Yeah. You know? And one way of doing this is rewilding the internet.
Yeah, so that's my big thing, is rewilding the internet.
Yeah. It's a beautiful, I think it also really speaks to mind. You like metaphors.
Yeah.
Not metaphors. Metaphors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially as a writer. Why are they so important? And maybe let's start, like, what does rewilding the internet mean?
Yeah, okay. So I'll go back to, rewilding was an idea that came to me one day. I was crossing the road and the idea of rewilding just dropped into my head and into my heart and my belly. Like, you feel, you know, you're a creator, you're an artistic person, you know, as a writer, sometimes an idea just feels like it is literally dropped from the sky and mm-hmm. you just, you know, you have a physical feeling, your body, like it falls into your body. Like, we are mammals moving through space and our ideas come. I feel like a lot of intelligence in that sense is fundamentally biological because we are creatures moving through space. But it actually came to, and this is why, going back to what we were saying about AI is important, is the work of reading and thinking and being and interrogating is so important, because
making new connections, seeing new patterns.
That's it, exactly. You've got to make space for your ideas. And not just in creating open and creative space, you know, the blank page, but also in kind of in seeking out different ideas. So a couple of years before, during lockdown, I remember I'd gotten to know someone a little bit on Twitter who I found his ideas really interesting, Robin Burton, my frequent collaborator.
And he's also on this show.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, he's just one of my favorite humans alive.
Amazing.
He's just such a brilliant and just sort of generative and generous person. Well, so basically, because he seemed so nice, we'd only ever kind of liked each other's tweets or whatever back when we used Twitter. We do not anymore. But I just DM'd him one day, and I just I did slide into his DMs, and I just said, like, hey, there's this book that you and I both seem to like. It's called Seeing Like a State by James C. Scott. It's basically about an American political anthropologist, and it's all about how centralizing and authoritarian ideas and structures are an awful idea, and how we can do other kinds of things. And I just DM'd him and just said, hey, how about we do Seeing Like a State, but for the internet? And Robin just DM'd me back straight away and was like, yes, absolutely. And so from that moment, we became collaborators who worked together and produced an article together for Noema magazine last year called We Need to Rewild the Internet. And so that's kind of all to say that the specific almost like branding or metaphor of rewilding popped into my head one day, but it came in as an idea to a very fertile, prepared space where, you know, I was kind of involved in developing ideas with other people. Kind of the moral of the story is you have to kind of read things and reach out to people and talk to them and be receptive to new ideas, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because the one thing that I was thinking about while I was reading the article, which was brilliant, was that we live in a highly, well, civil society where, you know, everything is, as you said, like a plantage. Everything is managed and operated and, you know, works a certain way. And rewilding, for example, we have in the Netherlands, we have a wolf or five wolves or so since a couple of years, which is super interesting because many nature enthusiasts, you know, say like this is great for our ecosystems. But people are now scared to walk in the forest because they might be attacked. Especially shepherds are complaining because, you know, their sheep got killed by wolves and they can claim, for example, subsidy to build fences. But the subsidy if a sheep is killed is higher. So it's a kind of a very odd structure kind of working around this new, well, inhabitant in our society. And that made me think, are we capable of rewilding something that is so tame as our world, but also the internet became, because we became so used to platformization, to these plantages. You know, often people, when they think about, I think especially youngsters, when they talk about the internet, they refer to either Instagram or TikTok, you know, where the internet is much more, but I think it's very closed into these systems.
Yeah, it's, well, there's a lot there to unpack, really. And I guess one of the things that first occurs to me is that rewilding as a process, as an ecological process and a political movement is not a settled thing. It's a constant iteration and in discussion and interrogation of what's working. Is this working? No. Can we try that? Yes, let's try that.
Something that is not really happening currently on the internet. It's just very determinative.
And for different people, they experience different internets. But I think it's almost a, you know, there's a generational aspect to this where a lot of people who are in their 20s and 30s now really only know a very suborned, a very captured, enclosed kind of internet, which is like two or three or four apps, you know, one search engine, two mobile phone operating systems, one desktop operating system, like, you know, it's three cloud providers, literally for the planet. Like, those numbers are crazy. And for a lot of people, that seems normal. So again, there's another idea that I could pull from ecology, and that's the idea of the shifting baseline syndrome. And it is something that ecologists use to talk about how everybody feels that the version of nature that they enjoyed in their youth is the optimal one. And so let's say the number of fish in the sea. If you grow up in, I don't know, the 1980s, there was a lot more fish. And you think that's the baseline we need to get back to. Mm-hmm. But if you grew up in the 1960s, there was even more. If you grew up in the 1890s, you could literally walk across, you know, the Bering Sea on the backs of whales. There were so many of them. And it's all to say, and to come back around to, rewilding is an unsettled and unsettling process, is that it's we're trying to not recreate a golden, idyllic, perfect past, but more to like find in almost like the cracks of the concrete, like mm-hmm. what can grow.
Yeah.
And to like keep making those cracks and making space. And I think that's why I like rewilding, as it's not like an authoritarian kind of almost totalitarian ideology of you must restore nature to this, you know, as it precisely was in this province of mm-hmm. the Netherlands in 1682,
because there is no point to go back to, because when is the right time? And yeah. I think it's also interesting because we, of course, the boundary of what we accept for the level of surveillance or the amount of apps that we use, of the amount of screen time that we have every day, is constantly moved forward. And yes. I think there are some very pressing times, especially COVID, you know, where, for example, everybody had to scan a QR code in order to enter a place, which is outrageous 10 years ago. But at some point it became normal. And that's kind of restored, but it didn't really, because it pushed the boundary of what we find normal in the level of surveillance and the level of obedience also to these machines very rapidly. And I think there are certain moments, especially now ChatGPT as well, it's interesting because it also kind of evokes these discussions about what's at stake, what are we fighting against, what do we have to be careful about. So it does both, I guess. But yeah, it certainly does.
Yeah, for sure. The like you say, it's almost like a, you know, as a feminist, I use and think a lot in feminist terms about this as well. And so much of the boundary pushing that we see, mostly from private companies, but also from states, is very redolent of the boundary pushing that an abusive person in a relationship does. Mm. You know, they're always kind of trying to, you know, and I've written about this a bit, like isolate you from your friends. Yeah, that's what a lot of social media does. It cuts you off from the feeds of the people that you know, you're on Instagram. You keep saying, I want to follow these feeds. I want to see what my friends are. And they keep giving you crap that you don't want. You
right. know, it's the stalker boyfriend.
It is like the stalker boyfriend.
Wow.
You know,
that's so interesting. Yeah.
And also the constant boundary pushing. Like, you know, you're always on the back foot wondering, is this OK? Is this behavior OK? Mm. I don't know. Like, everyone's doing it. It seems to be OK.
Yeah.
And so everybody, so you kind of isolate people. You make them feel like they're the only strange one for objecting. Like, so much of the playbook comes from the abusive, largely but not exclusively male predatory playbook. We see it. And, you know, and again, like, it's no accident that a lot of the people who are running these companies, you know, have some of those attributes themselves. Like, you know, I'm going to say it, like Elon Musk, how many children does he have? And with how many of his employees? Like, how is that? That is crazy. And so a lot of what I try to do, both using ecological and other, you know, using feminism, is to try and say, like, here's, okay, this stuff seems ubiquitous. It seems normal because you see it all the time. Like this guy having kids with his employees, or, you know, this company, you know, giving money to literal fascist presidents and rulers, several companies, all of them really. I constantly am trying to do something that novelists actually do, which is that you defamiliarize the everyday. You try and make the everyday look a bit weird.
Yeah, look weird.
Because when you realize it's weird, that kind of gives you the crack that you get into kind of go, okay, no, this is not normal. We can do something. We need to do something about this. Who else thinks this?
Yeah. That's very interesting. And I think also, like, for example, we are often referred to as internet users, Twitter users, Google users. And the only other vocabulary where users is used for that is in addiction, in drug addiction, alcoholic abuse. Like, you're a drug user, for example. And I think that's such an interesting parallel there, where I feel like that's what they want. They want to give us, you know, just enough heroin to come back all the time, you know. Just, I think that's, if you look at the internet like that, it's actually quite strange that we left it in the hands of a few big tech companies that are all interested in just, you know, filling shareholder pockets.
Yeah, like when you look at it, you realize there is a single business model, which is data extraction and manipulation. Like that's it. There's literally one.
Yeah.
Whereas if you even go back 15, 20 years, there are lots of other ways we can fund the internet. And so, you know, one of the other ideas I think about is the food web, which is in an ecosystem. An ecosystem is basically a set of kind of creatures, you know, animals, insects, the rest, who pass calories around.
Mm-hmm.
In an ecosystem that is even remotely functional, like you don't get what we get in our current internet, which is a tiny number of people who think of themselves as quote unquote apex predators, who are extracting calories from the system and parking them in tax-free bank accounts in the Caribbean, or you know, using my country, Ireland, is a key point of how they evade tax. And extract money from different economies. But like when you use ecology, you realize, hang on a second, okay, this is not, I kind of, always there's this temptation to say not natural, but I just feel like the word natural can be so misused in so many contexts. So I kind of think like this is not diverse, this is not healthy ecosystem. So I think, you know, one of the ways that we can kind of rebalance the internet into a healthy ecosystem is looking at, okay, this particular single business model that we have of data extraction, surveillance and manipulation via advertising. It's only one of very many possible ways we can fund the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I know you use Signal, I use Signal. I give them a fiver or a tenner a month.
Yeah.
Because
they're a great example that you don't have to exploit human rights in order to build a successful company or an app.
Exactly. Yeah. And like they're a non-profit. And so, you know, their legal structure is such that they cannot be turned into surveillance capitalism. And they're, you know, they're different. Proton Mail, the Swiss company, again, similar. They similarly converted themselves into a non-profit. So you kind of got the paying for your non-profit version. There's also the version of the internet, which is there are bits of it which, you know, are fundamental utilities, basically like electricity or water. And we have, you know, decades worth of regulation also for telecoms where we say, look, this stuff is, yes, we have to pay for it, but we also recognise that as a society, everybody needs to have it.
Right.
So
it's a basic fundamental right to have access to information, good information, to connectivity, to communications.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And to reliable news even.
Yeah.
So like we kind of go, okay, well, do we subsidise it? Do we say it's a utility and we make it a public utility? Like there are so many different funding models for how we can do this.
Yeah. But we also have to step down from the idea that the internet should be free, right?
Yeah.
Because why?
Yeah, it's not free.
No.
Like if it's the cost of it is democracy, it is definitely not free.
Yeah.
So
and it is at the moment.
Right now it is.
Yeah.
I had a great aunt, my great aunt Maura, she used to say the cheapest way to pay for anything is with money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the internet and that all the time.
Like,
you know, get rid of algorithmic feeds straight away.
Mm-hmm.
So much of your far right problem goes away on day one.
Yeah.
Literally on day one, you get rid of that. Which politicians are talking about doing that? Zero.
Yeah.
None of them. Lack of it's cowardice. It's a lack of courage. They're so suborned by tech lobbyists, by the tech view of the world, by the tech ideology. And so, but we know day one, we get rid of algorithmic feeds and so many of our problems go away.
Yeah, we need to resist, right?
Yeah. Yes, resistance.
That brings me to our final part of the conversation. So you are writing a book, Rewild and Resist.
Yeah.
What do we have to resist against?
So I think we have to resist against, first of all, the idea that four guys own the future, right? They do not. Or six guys, if you want to, you know. We have to resist that. And so I've worked in kind of digital rights, human rights, tech policy for, I mean, coming on 30 years. And the one thing I've learned to my cost over time is that we have spent so much of our time in the digital rights community saying, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. And we've had to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are life and death things that we've tried, you know, for decades to stop, to use state power to rein in some of the worst abuses. And that work is important, but it means that we are always responding. We're always reacting to the agenda that is set by, you know, six guys in Silicon Valley.
Right.
And various government ministers who are too uncurious or too cowardly to really interrogate what the agenda really is.
Yeah. So, the point that they might be inflicted a little bit in their interest, they just ally with them.
Yeah.
No matter what.
Yeah.
Profit over people.
Profit over people and just laziness and cowardice and just, I don't know, there's a weird psychology to it, which is, yeah, way too much to get into right now. But but I think that what we've learned is, sorry, if I could just say that, is we only go so far by saying no to things. We have to figure out what it is we want to say yes to, and we have to build that, because that is the only way you make change in this world, is you build the thing that you want to see and then people come to you. So I think so in terms of resist, how do we resist? Well, straight up. So most people, you know, are using social media. Are you using a form of social media that is part of those companies? That is, you know, part of the data extraction, surveillance economy? Then honestly, like, get off it. I think in conscience, you know, and I know people don't want to hear this because they love these applications, these platforms. You need to get off WhatsApp. You need to get off Instagram. You need to get off Twitter. You need to push back when your employer says, we're all going to, you know, we can only have Amazon Web Services. Mm-hmm. We can only have Microsoft Azure. You need to push back every time. And so, you know, those things are hard because for a lot of people, a lot of their daily infrastructure of life is on WhatsApp. So, okay, maybe you can't get off the WhatsApp group that decides, you know, that tells you what time your kids get off school or whatever. But you can certainly get off the one with your friends.
Yeah.
You know, you can certainly...
you can mobilize people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can look at the alternatives to Instagram that exist right now.
Mm-hmm.
And
they can also grow when people step in.
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, you know, it's not the only thing going. Like, I use Mastodon, I use Blue Sky. You know, I got off Twitter. I didn't bother deleting it because there's no sense in which these companies ever delete your data when you ask them. But I stopped using it, you know, you stopped cold turkey. And I just think we have to, you know, as they say, be the change you want to see in the world. Like, I'm sorry, don't, you know, whinge and whine about big tech being the bad guys if you're still using Instagram. Like, it's a moral act, and we are responsible for thinking through who we are in this world and what we want, you know, who we want to be with, what we want to do, the things we think are important with. And there are alternatives out there, and I think we have to start using them.
Mm.
But also, you know, bear in mind, and, you know, as Paris Mark said today at the conference, state power is needed to coerce lawfulness into these companies, because they are lawless. They are active agents of evil in this world right now. And I know that's a crazy sounding thing to say, but you only have to look at everything from the Rohingya genocide, 10 years ago, all the way to what's happening today in Gaza. And all of those companies are complicit in that, every single one of them. And so us with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to also use state power to corral them into better behavior, to break them up, because those companies are bigger than most governments.
Yeah.
So they are not, the continued existence of those companies in those forms are not consistent with democratic oversight and government. So we have to break them up. We also have to use competition policy to do that. And I think we also have to use governments as procurement, governments who are making decisions. And, you know, already, like, there's so many, just in the last couple of months, literally this week, the digital economy minister of Denmark said that she was getting, they were getting off a bunch of big tech software and starting to use parts of the euro stack, so to speak.
Amazing.
You know, the government of Schleswig-Holstein, you know, that little bit in between because Denmark
the moment
and Germany.
When a government trusted also these systems, then people can also see, hey, they're reliable, they can scale up, they can grow. You know, that's kind of a great way to incentivize also alternatives to stand up.
It is, by buying them and using them.
Yeah, especially also, for governments.
Yeah, for governments. Like, that's their job, is to both, you know, break up the monopolies, which are destroying our democracy, but also to kind of seed the ground for some of the big replacements, the replacements of large capacities, because there's still a lot of, a lot of governments, a lot of key parts of internet infrastructure, like domain name service providers, who say we can only use AWS. Right. So we have to, from a strategic perspective, use industrial policy to make there be alternatives.
Do you believe that there will be a world without big tech?
I live in a world without big tech. Like, I know people who already live in this world. Mm-hmm. Like this, famously the American science fiction writer William Gibson said, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, I live inside digital spaces created by people, with non-algorithmic feeds that are building public social media that has choice, that is, non-destructive of democracy, that also doesn't make you feel shitty when you use it, right? Mm-hmm. That's part of this too. People feel so disempowered. Like, you pick up your phone, you're at the tram stop, you doom scroll for 7 minutes while you're waiting. Do you feel better when you get on the tram? You do not.
You do not.
You know, you're being kind of consistently and persistently disempowered, I guess, made to feel a little bit crappy, like humans are just a bit crap and what are we ever going to be able to do? That's just not how humans have ever made change in the world.
We have to take back that power.
We've got to take it back. And it involves a bit of discomfort. It involves resistance. Mm-hmm. So I think those are kind of two key locuses for resistance. One, state power. Two, individual choice. Also, as workers, we get to resist. Mm-hmm. One of the big kind of worker movements in tech, which, sadly, I think has come to a halt really 4 or 5 years ago, was a lot of particularly American tech workers for Amazon, for Microsoft and for Google organized to say, first of all, to be allowed to have unions, because there's this whole kind of stigma that middle class white people, whatever, don't have or need unions. Knowledge workers don't need unions. That's nonsense. Mm-hmm. That's just a fiction to disempower people. But they also kind of organize to say, like, we don't want to be working on products, tech products that are being used to, carry out war crimes. The tech firms have had successive waves of tens of thousands of people being laid off. And a lot of it was motivated by the desire to bring that movement to a finish. But nonetheless, we still, we operate in workplaces and we still have points and ways and methods of resistance. Like, we can slow walk things when we're told we have to do something that we think is wrong. Not everyone can maybe resign on day one, but you can slow walk it. You can just like go, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And then you don't. And this is, again, James C. Scott, the American political anthropologist, wrote a whole book about what he called Weapons of the Weak. And it's really about how people through history have resisted by being kind of sullenly disobedient. Mm-hmm. He actually calls this Irish resistance, which I'm a little bit insulted by, but he's not wrong. We invented the boycott, for example.
Yeah.
There are different ways of resisting. And I'm reading a book about Hannah Arendt at the moment, the German thinker. And she was a big reader of Immanuel Kant, and she had a lot of things to say, but one of them in particular was, we do not have the right to obey. Mm. And it's a weird sentence. We do not have the right to obey. Like, it sort of brushes against the grain of what we think. Mm-hmm. And it's basically saying that we are required to be thinking, considering humans in the world. It is our moral duty to be people who think about who we are, what we're doing, what does it mean. And in so doing, we can't just kind of nod along and use the same app that everyone uses and go, work said I have to do this thing, so I have to do it. Or, my university is doing things in a certain way, so I guess I have to go along with it. Like, we don't, not just we can resist, but we have a duty to resist. So I think, probably wrapping things up maybe a bit now, but I think, in the duty of hope is the duty of resistance. And our work is not just the paid work we do every day, although that's a really important scene where we get things done. But our work is the blank page. It's the figuring out who I am, who are my people, who can I work with. And it's also the figuring out I'm required to make a space to think of alternative futures and start building them in my small acts every day. And the big acts I require of the state and the big acts I require of us collectively. That's the work of our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think there is something joyous, honestly, in personally as a middle-aged woman, in having kind of built up to that over a period of decades, It's freeing. It's joyous. You get to hang out with all sorts of people who you didn't think you would. And you just, once you figure out what your life's work is, it kind of brings you to the people you want to work with. And that, I think, is life-changing and hope-growing in the most generative possible way.
That's, I think, the most beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
It's a delight being on here. Thank you so much for
your
questions.
Thank you so much. Let's all have hope.
Amen.
Data Morgana is funded by the European Union. Views and opinions expressed are, however, those of the authors only and do not necessarily reflect those of the European Union or the Directorate General for Communications Network Content and Technology. Neither the European Union nor the granting authority can be held responsible for them.